Here's a pioneer. Yes, once again, it's time for us to turn back the pages with another 15-minute presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company of Fairbanks. Manager Joe Coble and the Pioneer staff hope you're enjoying this series, and they also suggest that you make a note of the number to call when you want a Pioneer cab. It's East 10A, the Pioneer Cab Company. Now, this week's man with the answers about the early days is Mr. R.H. Burt Ogburn of Fairbanks. Mr. Ogburn, I'm going to begin by asking you the familiar question, when did you first come north?
I left Seattle about March 10th, 1901, and landed in Dawson on April 1st.
Well, what was it that made you decide to come to the Northland?
Well, my dad had gone to Dawson with a stampede in 1897. Mother followed in 99, and they came out in the fall of 1900, and I went back with Dad. Mother followed in June of that year.
Well, something that interests all the Cheechakers, and I include myself in the list, is the means of travel that you chose to come up here.
Well, I traveled the usual manner, at least as far as Whitehorse. Came by steamer to Skagway and then train to Whitehorse. But from then on, I a little unusual, and rode a bicycle.
By bicycle. Well, are there any particular memories of that trip that seem to stick in your mind?
Well, on the trip up the river, up the coast, I remember quite plainly meeting Father Duncan and hearing him preach, and heard about his colony at Metlakatla. And then also Ketchikan, which I've seen many times since and can hardly realize it's grown from the few cabins along a stream that I saw then. And then in Skagway, I saw my first dance halls and gambling houses, and my eyes sure popped out at the stacks of silver dollars that I saw on the gambling tables.
That must have been some experience for a growing boy. How old were you then?
I was just past 15.
How was that train trip to Whitehorse?
Well, it was awfully slow. We didn't land in Whitehorse till after midnight, and I know we had to sleep in the hall in the hotel, the only room we could get left.
Mm-hmm. How about the remaining part of the trip from Whitehorse to Dawson?
Well, Dad and I had both planned to used bikes going down, but when he got to Whitehorse, Dad got a chance to buy a team from a man who'd got cold feet. And Dad sold his bike after buying the team, let me keep mine, intending to have me travel along with him. But I made the first roadhouse about 15 miles away ahead of him, and the next morning it was the same way, so I talked him into letting me go ahead, so he did.
Uh-huh. And I suppose you got along pretty well after that. Were there any other young boys making the trip at that time?
Well, I didn't see any. I've always claimed to be the youngest to make that trip over the trail alone. And if anyone hearing this knows of any younger, I'd like to hear about them.
Well, do you have anything to add about the trip in general?
Well, the trip was pretty good. I had no real trouble at all. The route at that time followed the river almost entirely, except for one cutoff from Lower LaBarge to Carmax, about 60 miles. That was known as the Canadian Development Cutoff. The whole trip took about 10 days. I made from 20 to 66 miles a day. I lost 2 days on account of getting sick.
What was your cause of being sick there? Did you know?
Oh, yes. I got some sour beans at a roadhouse and didn't feel so good afterwards.
Uh-huh. You know, your mode of transportation is something that really tickles me. Were there any other bicycles on the trail?
Well, there were quite a few, but I always heard there were many more that started with them and gave up. When the snowstorm would come along and the trail would get heavy, people pushed their bike for a ways, but that got pretty tough. So they claimed that they threw their bikes off the trail and went on unencumbered. I think that was rather foolish because of the amount of travel that was over the trail at that time. The trail soon packed and the going got good again.
How about yourself? Did you have any trouble?
No, I made it fine all the way except the last day when I ran into a snowstorm and made the going pretty tough, but I was lucky and caught a freight team and rode the last 10 miles on the team.
Well, Mr. Ogburn, what was Dawson like in those days?
Well, I didn't see much of it right then because I went right out onto the creeks, Last Chance Creek, where my dad had his mine. But, of course, during the summer, I saw quite a bit, and it was a lively town. There was plenty doing all the time. The gambling houses and the dance halls were all running, and business was booming.
Well, how about your life out on the creeks then?
Well, for me, it was just a few odd jobs for the miners around there that summer, and I played about as much as I could. Being only 15, I didn't like to work too steady.
Well, I would be inclined to agree with you. Did you do any mining yourself?
Well, another kid and I fixed up a rocker and sniped on some tinnings, and we made about $4 to $5 in a day, and our days were pretty short. So all we wanted really was enough money to buy ammunition for squirrel and rabbit hunting, which are our main means of amusement.
Well, what about your later experiences then?
Well, that winter, 1912, I did a lot of odd jobs. Dragged buckets down in the shafts for some of the fellas. Did some windlassing for prospectors. And hauled ice with a dog team for use for water. The water was very poor around there. The next summer, summer 1902, I fired a boiler most of the summer. And then went out to school that fall.
Mm-hmm. And what were the general conditions in that vicinity in those days, the roads and so on?
Well, there wasn't much roads except makeshift roads up on the ridges that were pretty good in dry weather, but took a lot of up and downhill. And at the heads of each creek, there was a kind of a snake road of some kind that let them drag the wagons down to the heads of the creeks, but it was pretty tough traveling.
What do you remember about the social life of the early days?
Well, social life on the creeks was really something. There were lots of people there, and they all got together to have a good time. Nearly all communities had a social hall, and people met there for their dances and parties. And the outstanding thing about it, there was absolutely no social distinctions. Not even later, after we moved to town, the social distinctions just weren't. The prize example of social democracy in the North that I remember was at one big ball in Dawson when the wife of the governor, then governor, Mrs. George Black, and the town scavenger were dancing together, and also one of the minister's wife and a professional gambler. That was something.
Well, I don't imagine that you lived out there in the creeks all the time. What about your later life? When did you move to Dawson?
We moved into Dawson in the fall of 1905. And that winter, Dad came to Fairbanks. That was in January, '06. Then the next spring, I started work in the survey for the Klondike Mines Railroad, which was built out to the creeks there. And then that fall, I prospected down on Walker's Fork in the 40 Mile. The next spring, in 1907, I started to work for the Yukon Gold Company and worked with them until they finished operations in 1925.
If you don't mind explaining, just what was the Yukon Gold Company?
The Yukon Gold Company might have been called the F.E. Company of the Klondike. They started the first large-scale dredging operations up there. The operations were very similar to the F.E. operations here. They had dredges, thawing plants, hydraulicking, and ditches. The thawing plants were mostly steam thaw because water thaw had not yet developed, and the hydraulicking was hydraulicking of gravels off the benches, different than here where most of the hydraulicking is removal of overburden, which contains no gold.
Were you in Dawson until coming to Fairbanks?
Most of the time, but I made a trip to Iditarod in 1918 and again in 1920. That was sure a long and slow trip at that time. The river, you waited for boats, and in the summer you traveled by boats, and in the winter you went around by Juneau and Seward and Wasilla and then took a dog team into the Iditarod.
Mr. Ogburn, when did you finally come to Fairbanks?
In October 1925.
What means of travel did you choose then? That was 21 years ago, wasn't it?
I took a small boat using oar power from Dawson to Circle, and then mushed over the winter trail. It had no summer road at all, to Cassiar, about 50 miles out of Fairbanks, and there I was met by a car which was sent out from Fairbanks for me.
Mm-hmm. Did you stay here in Fairbanks then?
No, just a few days then to get acquainted with the company and the officials, and then went out to meet my family who had gone out by way of Whitehorse.
Did you really intend to come back at that time?
Really, no. It was the second time I'd made up my mind to locate outside. But, however, after looking things over out there, just as I did before, I changed my mind. The North looked good to me, and I beat the geese back the next spring, arriving here in March 1926.
Well, what was Fairbanks like back there in 1926?
It was just beginning to show signs of a rebirth. The F.E. Company had started construction, but the town was still pretty dead from the period of inactivity that had gone on for some years before. Property values were still low, and individual mining was down to almost nothing. But the F.E. Company started their construction work and put on a lot of men, and a spirit of optimism started to prevail, and a good deal of modernizing of home was done at that time.
I wonder about modernization in other lines here in Fairbanks at that time.
Well, it was really the beginning of big-scale aviation. A lot of road building started at that time, and concrete construction got a start. The FE used it in some of their construction, and then others began to use it, and big buildings such as Captain Lathrop and others put up since then really got started about that time.
You know, it may be interesting to note, now, this was just before the big depression. Did you really feel the depression here in Fairbanks?
No, in a way, the depression was rather good for the town because it, up the time times got poor outside, workmen were kind of scarce up here. And then they began to come up here, and in a way, business was better because of the fact that there were plenty of men to be had at all times.
It seems to me that you got here to Fairbanks just in time to witness the birth of Alaskan aviation. Will you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I think that spring of 26 was really the birth of the big aviation up here, because that was the year that Sir Hubert Wilkins and Ben Allison were getting ready to make, and did make later, their first flights to Point Barrow. The town and aviation got a big bunch of publicity then. And it wasn't long until Noel Ween and A. Bennett and Al Young and some of the other old flyers were shooting, flying anywhere in Alaska that anyone wanted to go. Then the PAA got started about 1930, and their service has continually improved since that time.
Well, Mr. Ogburn, your experience in Alaska is certainly deep-rooted in the past. I'm wondering what you have to say in regard to the future of the Northland.
Well, Al, I think that's a $64 question. The future of Alaska is certain. No frontier remains static, and progress is certainly heading towards Alaska. However, for the most important natural economy of this district, that is mining, the future looks pretty dim. So long as it's considered necessary to rush the government constructing in this district, which takes up practically all the available accommodations and pays a wage scale that only the richest mining ground can afford, mining is going to be rather dead, or at the best, dormant. The miner, as I see it, is between the fire and the frying pan. He's got two choices, either to give up entirely or just high-grade his ground, which means wasting the natural resources of the country. You have heard the definition of a miner, an optimist who owns a hole in the ground. If that definition is right, there are a few miners left. Most are now pessimists. However, Alaska has been good to me. I'm thankful that I've been lucky enough to have lived most of my life here, and I'm sure that many future generations will say the same.
All right, and thank you very much, Mr. Ogburn. Friends, you've listened to another in the series of interviews with Alaska's old-timers called Here's a Pioneer. This week's studio guest was Mr. R.H. Ogburn, an old-timer in local transportation. The Pioneer Cab Company suggests that you remember their new number, East 10A, for service anytime. And listen to Here's a Pioneer again next Wednesday evening at 7:30. Well, here it is Wednesday evening at 7:30, and we bring you Here's a Pioneer. And Here's a Pioneer for Carnival Week, of course, would bring you the King Regent for the 1947 Dog Derby and Ice Carnival. And his name, of course, is Henry Appel. And I think I will begin by asking Mr. Appel how old he is right now.
Well, I passed the 81-year mark 24th of January last.
The 24th of January, you were 81 years old.
Yes.
Uh-huh. First of all, now perhaps we'd better ask is how you happened to be selected as King Regent for the carnival.
Well, I happened to be a member of Pioneers, you see, and they just picked on me. I considered quite a great honor.
Yes.
For the pioneers to give me the chance to represent them.
I should imagine so. It really is something that goes down in Fairbanks history and will always be remembered, your being the King Regent of the 1947 Carnival. Now, Mr. Appel, getting into your personal history, what was your home down in the States?
I was born just outside of the old town of St. Louis, Missouri.
Uh-huh. How old were you when you decided to come to Alaska?
About 28.
Hmm. And just what was it that made you decide to come such a great distance?
Well, I got a bad dose of malaria, the old egg, into my system, and the doctors told me to come north and have it froze out of me.
Malaria? Then you certainly must have spent some time in the tropics to contract that.
No, there was plenty right at home in the States.
Malaria was then widespread in the States?
It was along all them streams and bottomlands.
Uh-huh. Well, what year was it that the doctor told you to come north to get rid of malaria?
What, 1893.
1893, and then you came up here in 94, didn't you?
Yes, I landed up here in 1894.
Then you've been in the Northland, actually, over half a century.
I have.
Mm-hmm. And I imagine you intend to spend the rest of your years up here.
I intend to leave my old bones up here.
Oh, fine. I understand you already had a relative living up here in the North Country at that time.
At that time, I had a brother-in-law up in the 40-mile country. He was mining up there.
Mm-hmm. Wonder, Mr. Appel, if you would tell us something of your trip to the north. Which route did you choose?
Well, I came to Edmonton first. From Edmonton, we went to Athabasca Landing on the Athabasca River and waited till the ice went out and then floated down the river till the freeze up in the fall. And then we took dogs and came over Rat Portage and down to Porcupine into Fort Yukon.
I see. It sounds easy the way you tell it, but I imagine it took a long time and a lot of hardships to make that trip.
Slow work.
Uh-huh. How long did it actually take you to make that trip?
Practically a year.
Almost a year?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You said you floated downriver. What kind of transportation did you use there?
Canoes. We had our own canoes.
Mm-hmm. What did you depend on for food supply?
Well, all them Hudson Bay posts, they had a little outside grub. Mm-hmm. And we bought whatever we needed at every post.
Then your eventual destination here in the North Country was Fort Yukon. Was Fort Yukon pretty well established at that time?
It was still a small place, though.
A small place, but probably by the time you got up here, it looked pretty big.
It did look pretty good to us when we got there.
Uh-huh. Looked like a metropolis. Well, what did you do for a livelihood when you did get up here?
Well, I done a little trapping there.
Uh-huh. Did you intend
one for my brother-in-law a month or so, and then the next winter I've been trapping.
Mm-hmm. Did you have intentions of staying here as long as you have, or did you intend to come up for a season or so to get rid of that malaria?
Well, I don't know. I just came up here and stayed and never got away.
Uh-huh. Your plans were pretty well indefinite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You say you did some trapping, and I wonder what other kinds of work that you've done up in this country besides trapping and prospecting and mining.
I've done quite a bit of work for the Alaska Road Commission, working on the road.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, I know that you're interested in the progress of Alaska. Can you mention some of the territory's major needs at this time?
Well, they should have more roads and better roads. That new road up into the 40 mile that should be finished. It'll open up quite a mining country, and a lot of work should be done on these older roads. And I'm mainly interested in that road to Circle City.
Oh,
you see, last spring I got stuck in an awful bad mud hole. And I'd like to have them fix it up so I won't get stuck this spring.
Uh-huh.
Of course, well, what helped my feelings out, road commission boss got stuck himself in that same mud hole.
I suppose that did make you feel much, much happier.
A bit.
You spoke of Circle. I understand that's a country that's really dear to your heart. You really call that home even more than Fairbanks.
It's my home, God, yeah.
How long have you lived here in Fairbanks?
Since about 41.
Since 1941.
Yeah.
And the Circle District is your home, and I suppose you go back there quite frequently.
As quick as this spring, I'll go back and stay till fall.
You know, coming back to this question about the progress of Alaska, you've certainly had plenty of opportunity to view the needs of the territory in regard to transportation. What do you have to say about the transportation facilities to the states? I suppose you would regard them as being important, too.
Oh, yes. We need just as bad as the transportation up here. We have to get supplies in. That's all there's to it.
And as it stands now, it's generally regarded as unsatisfactory.
It is very unsatisfactory.
Mm-hmm. Wonder how many trips you've made out there to the states since you came to Alaska.
I went out a year ago this winter.
Oh, you mean you've made one trip?
Yes.
One trip has been all. How long did you stay then?
About 25 days or so.
Uh-huh. I suppose you had seen enough movies and magazines and so on so that you had a pretty good idea of what it was like out in the States, but were there some things about the States that really surprised you?
Yes, the amount of people all in Seattle and them places.
A little too much population.
Uh-huh. Too many for me.
This over half a century in the North Country sort of convinced you that this is the place of peace and quiet, then.
It is.
Uh-huh. What about the trip itself? Wasn't it quite a difference getting out there in a few hours compared to that trip that took you a year to get up here from St. Louis to Fort Yukon?
Oh, yes. It's a big difference. I went out on the PAA, left here in the morning, went in Seattle at night, and when I came back, I left there in the morning, was home at night.
Uh-huh. How did the Pan-American people take care of you?
They took very good care of me. I was afraid I might get sick, but then I never got sick. They were a very nice bunch of people.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mr. Appel, I guess you're just about the earliest pioneer that I know of. Can you remember offhand the names of some of those men who were up here in 1894? Golly, that seems a long way back. Some of those men who were here in 94 who are still in Alaska or Yukon Territory.
Well, there's one man by the name of Jim Stewart, and Gaspar Erlinger, and Neil McDonald, of course, he's over on the above Old Crow in Yukon Territory, but then that's still in up here. Mm-hmm. And a man by the name of Herman Price, he's on the Lower River someplace.
Oh, yes.
There's the only four I can remember just now.
I imagine there were many, even hundreds more at that time, because it is a pretty big country. And
with
communication being so poor, you probably didn't get really a chance to communicate with very many of them. What was it like up here at that time? Was it extremely sparsely populated? Did it seem to you that there were very few white people there in 94?
Not many, but still there was quite a few, too, you know.
This was actually before the days of the gold rush. What was their purpose? Certainly they didn't all have malaria and decide to come to Alaska. What were they doing up here?
Well, there was quite a bit of mining going on.
Oh, yes.
And bar mining on the upper river. And up in the 40 mile and different creeks, you see.
Uh-huh. Well, that's understandable, and I suppose they also did quite a bit of trapping, too.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And you say that in the Canadian territory, the Hudson's Bay Company was established for the benefit of these people who really pioneered the North Country at that time. Were there any river boats at that time? I imagine not.
Yes, Jack McQuestion had a small boat. And once in a while, a trader would come up from St. Michael's. Mm-hmm. He just had a small boat. Some summers he might come up, and some summers he wouldn't.
I see. Well, that seems to pretty well cover the situation, Henry Appel. We've certainly been pleased to have you here with us. I'm wondering now about your role as King Regent for the carnival here. Within the next few days, what kind of public appearances are they going to call on you to make?
Well, I don't know yet. They haven't told me yet. Uh-huh. They're holding out on me, you see. They won't tell me till the very last minute.
Uh-huh. Well, if last year's carnival is any criterion, I'm sure that you'll be seen down there for the coronation. I believe that's about 1:30 on Sunday, and you'll make your appearance with the Queen Regent. That is Blanche Cascaden, isn't it?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And, of course, with we'll know who Miss Fairbanks is by that time, so there'll be a great to-do down there. So we'll be counting on seeing you there at 1:30 on Sunday. Well, Henry, I believe we've pretty well covered the situation now. I wonder if there's any last word that you'd like to have to your friends. You know, no doubt you've got a lot of these old-timers who knew you from the early days listening in various parts of the North Country right now.
Yeah, you know, there's quite a few, but
Well, they'll probably be happy to have heard your voice. And that pretty well sums up this interview on the program Here's a Pioneer. And right now we might mention that the Pioneer Cab Company suggests that if you want to go places during the carnival, the number to call is East 10A. And as you all know, the cab stand for Pioneer is located very conveniently right across the street from the Nordale Hotel. You've listened to an interview with Henry Appel, chosen King Regent for the 1947 Dog Derby and Ice Carnival. Listen for another presentation of Here's a Pioneer at the same time next Wednesday evening. Another Wednesday evening at 7:30 is time for Here's a Pioneer, weekly presentation of the Pioneer Cab Company, which brings you an interview with one of Alaska's genuine old-timers. The Pioneer Cab Company, you know, is located across from the Nordale Hotel on 2nd Avenue, and their telephone number, 24 hours a day, is East 108. We're especially happy this week to have one of the old-timers from over on the Seward Peninsula, Mr. Charles D. Jones of Nome, Alaska. Mr. Jones, I think it would be in order for me to ask just what you're doing in Fairbanks at this time.
I'm on my way back home after the close of the legislature. I went out and had a physical checkup, and the doctor said he wanted me to come back in 60 days. So when I was out, I just stayed the 60 days and got through with him, and I'm on my way back to go to work over there at Nome.
I imagine you'll be mighty happy to get back on home ground again.
I certainly will.
Well, fine. Well, suppose we retrace your steps, the steps that led you to Alaska in the first place. What year did you come to the North?
I came and I got in the Nome and I went in the old Centennial. I left sometime the last of May and got in the Nome early in June, sometime in the before, I think, the 15th of June. It's about that time, anyway.
June of 1900.
Yes, sir.
Now, what was the stage of the activity there at Nome? Was that before the strike, or how?
Well, that was after the strike. The strike was made late in 98.
Do you remember who did make the strike and how it happened?
Well, as I say, the Linderblom, Brinderson, and Lindbergh, there were the three that were together with some other men. They went over, I think, to Gullivan and got Gabe Price. And he came up there and showed them how to organize a district, a mining district. In those days, it took eight people to organize a mining district and recording district. And Dr. Kettleson was the first recorder. Uh-huh. And that they recorded all their claims. And those records are the foundation records of what we use in our recording office now.
Mm-hmm. Your home down in the States was Chicago, wasn't it?
Well, no, my home was Zanesville, Ohio, but I'd been working in Chicago when I left to come for up at Nome here. Uh-huh.
Whatever attracted you to come north?
Well, just like all kids with a gypsy foot, I guess.
What sort of an age were you at that time?
23.
You were 23.
Yes, sir.
And you had a smooth trip to Alaska?
I guess so.
Didn't
mean much to me, but just going somewhere, you know.
Were you disappointed when you saw Nome that first time?
No, because I hadn't expected anything, and I just took her in the stride. What it was all right with me, see.
What was your first impression of Nome?
Well, brother, I was too busy. I was getting around trying to get my grub together and get things going and find out where I was. I can't recall that. It was just, I knew that there was something different, and I just accepted it. That was all.
Did you find that there were a lot of frame buildings, or was the town mostly tents?
Well, when we got there on Front Street, there was quite a few buildings, but the work was going on. It was in the building stage when I got there for what the town really became.
I imagine it was pretty flimsy, too, wasn't it?
Oh, yes, just run her up and get her undercover so that he could get into it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in June of 1900, I suppose there was a lot of freight around there, too.
Oh, my God, it was. I counted one time 26 ships in the harbor there, and they just piled freight on there. They didn't have any warehouses or place. They just piled it up in piles on the beach. And if you had a tarpaulin to throw over it, well, good. If you didn't, why, just she stood there.
Uh-huh. Well, I would like to know some more about those early days. How many saloons? I suppose they did have at least one or two there in Nome.
Well, I think they had, if I remember, there were 68 saloon licenses. That's saloons and dance halls and places where they sold booze.
Mm-hmm. Dance halls, in that sense of the word, are something that have died.
Oh, you don't see them anymore.
Uh-huh.
There was all, these James, you know, were in there, and you paid 6 bits a dance. The girl got a check, and it cost her 2 bits for her drink and 2 bits for your drink, and they rustled on percentage, you see. They danced.
Mm-hmm. Where did you stay when you first got to Nome?
I put up a tent the first day that I was there.
There wasn't even standing room in the
hotels. Oh, heaven. Hotels, they were building the hotels.
Mm-hmm. How about the prices in those days? How did they compare with around in Chicago where you'd been working, and
well,
also
about
the prices
times,
now?
Three to four times as much. Mm-hmm.
Was that as much as we have to pay now for commodities?
Well, I think the prices now are higher than when I first went to Nome. Hmm. Well, now, for instance, you take in a year or so, I've seen kind of got settled down to the big rush. You would pay $15 a ton for coal in the yard, and now it costs $40 a ton. You'd pay beef with a side when we were buying it for the camp. It cost us 16 cents, and now it's 26 to 32, according to the type of beef you're getting. And everything is in proportion the same way. The prices now are much higher than they were in those days.
Was the community really prosperous in those days? Were those men out on the beach really making money?
Oh, there was plenty of money made on the beach. Nobody will never know how much money there was made on the beach. Well, some of the old-timers over there and there now, they know after a storm, they'll get a concentration, they'll pick up 20 or 30 ounces pretty doggone quick. Sometimes just five or six or like that. It's just how it happens to concentrate, you see.
What different methods did these fellows use there in the early days?
Brother, they used everything in the world. Everyone had a different idea how they were going to get it. They were from fellows with setting a pan down to the crank to swirl it around instead of get around to getting down on their hunkers and panning it, and then they had, I saw one outfit, the one that amused me the most of anything, they'd build an A-frame and swung a big pendulum loaded with sandbags to pump their water up and then use it in their long tom. There was five of those fellas working together.
And what's a long tom?
Well, a long tom is different from a rocker. A long tom is just a sort of an abbreviated sluice box. And a rocker, you know, you rock the dirt just like you do a cradle. It's made like a cradle with the rockers on it, and you throw the dirt in and splash it with your water from a sump alongside of you and throw the rocks out of the screen is really what it is. And then the dirt comes down across these aprons that have little pockets in, and in these pockets is where the gold is supposed to catch, you see. And a long tom is just like you'll take a piece of cocoa matting or some heavy gunny sack and put a screen over that, and you'll have on top of that you'll get a piece of tin and punch holes through it, so it's let all the fine dirt go through, and then that's on a hinge so that you can throw those rocks out to the side.
I understand.
And then the afters developed a surf washer that they'd run it right down when the surf wasn't too high, and the surf would drag the dirt down over these plates. And weren't that way, you could move more dirt in the surf washer than any other method they had. There was a man working by himself.
I'm sure that many an old-timer listener will understand what you're talking about a lot sooner than I will.
Oh, they all know that stuff, you know.
What kind of an early government did you have there? Any formality about the law?
Well, you see, the court came right there in 1900 and built a courthouse, and they established the government right there. They created the second division in Alaska there, and that was made, the headquarters was made at St. Michael's, and then it was afterwards transferred to Nome. But this, we had the judge and the district attorney and the marshal and all the federal officials, U.S. commissioner and everything, and along with the city government, why, we had pretty good laws. Oh, there was some killings. There's always been any mob like that, you know.
I understand that the weather has imposed a lot of difficulties on Nome. Perhaps that's a roundabout way of saying it, but you've had a number of disasters over there. What was the first really big disaster?
Well, the first anything where I saw the town damaged anything in September 1900, September 13th, 1900. And that was the first big storm, and that was down where they had built. You see, the town goes along, and then there was down around the mouth of the Snake River there, there's some low ground, and lots of people had built in there, and that wasn't a very good place to build. The waves got in there and wrecked quite a bit of damage in there.
What is the biggest fire that ever hit Nome?
Well, the one that burnt the town down, that's what we always talk of. That was about 1934 or 5, one of those years. Is not fixed in my memory, only just relatively. See.
Now, do you mean it really burned the town down?
Oh, the whole center of the town, it was the whole business section of the town was just ashes, that was all. She just cleaned her out and cleaned her up, clear up to on the south side of First Avenue.
it burnt clear up to putting her to D Street.
How did that fire start? Does anyone know?
Well, because the common belief is it was a still blew up in the Golden Gate Hotel, on the third floor of the Golden Gate Hotel, because there's where the fire started, and it was a terrific wind, and she just tear those boards off and carry them. It was a terrific gale blowing at the time, and the whole board had come off the side of a building, and just where she lit, you couldn't put them all out, and everything in town started and burnt, that was all.
I suppose the town started rebuilding before the ashes were cold.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, they went out in the hills and brought in some of these old shacks that had the mining was done, and they brought those in and started up, and some of them have just been built on to since. But there's some good buildings that have been put up.
Well, if it isn't fire, it's flood. And while we're on the subject of disasters, what was the highest and most disastrous flood that you ever endured over there?
Well, in my opinion, I think the big flood in 1913 was the highest one that I've seen. There's argument, but that this last one in summer year ago, it was high. But I don't believe it was. In my opinion, I don't think it was, because I saw the water marks on the creeks where they carried this stuff to, and it didn't carry it near back as far as they did in 1913. You see, their graveyard was on the west of the town there, built on the bluff over there. In 1913, it washed out any amount of those graves that were on the edge of that bluff. And she didn't go back this far this time. So that I'm just, in my own opinion, I don't think it was as high a flood.
Hasn't that sort of convinced a lot of the people that they ought to move the town back?
Oh, well, that's been argued ever since they were in there.
And they probably never will.
I don't believe they will, because even if they did, there'd always be known, because that's where the port is. That's where the stuff is brought in, and the fellows that are working down there on there and the lighterage outfit, they'll have to have their offices and warehouses there so that the town will be there, in my opinion. If they were going to move the town, in my opinion, of course the government would never do it, but I think that by going down to Cape Nome and making a regular artificial harbor there, there's all the material in the world. It's a shattered rock. They could build a harbor there, and they could come right up to a dock. But the government's never going to do that, and we haven't got the money to do that. So where would we go? It's tundra right back of Nome, and you just go out in that tundra, and you don't have anything around here like the tundra we do. I've seen them walk all around in Fairbanks here. Well, they got pretty good ground. Some of it's a little boggy, but that isn't like tundra. The tundra's right on the frozen ground, and it's you get into it, it's just tundra, that's all. I can't describe it to you if you haven't seen it. No, you have to gravel on there to do it, you see. And that's what they did along the beach there, and gradually as the drains were built through it and become firmer, and the years that we've lived there hauling stuff on, we've got some pretty good pieces of property along down there. And we fellows, the old fellows, I know I'd never move away from there. I don't care where they went. If I had to live by myself, I'd be the only one there. That's where I'd be living. Because
you seem pretty well convinced that Nome has a good future.
I absolutely believe in the second division, and I believe in the Seward Peninsula, that she'll be a treasure house for the United States of America.
And that is based on mineral wealth.
Mineral, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Mineral wealth altogether. Because the only thing in the way, gardens like you people have, we can't. But we can have something there. And by working around and carefully, we can have little window gardens and little greenhouses, all that. You can have all that kind of short green stuff. But down Unalak Creek now, they go wonderful gardens down there, something like you people do here. But they don't get that at home. We're right out there where we get that. You see, if you'll notice the topography, you'll see that we run due east and west at Nome. And we get that current comes down, it comes in from the southwest, and it strikes along there. Well, that it brings all of that cold water that comes down from the Arctic. That's why we have the kind of climate we do there at Nome.
Well, Mr. Jones, I understand you have to catch a plane for Nome pretty soon,
yeah.
So I think we'll have to bring closed our 15-minute interview. We've certainly enjoyed speaking with you. You've listened to an interview with Mr. Charles D. Jones, pioneer resident of Nome. Here's a Pioneer is brought to you by the Pioneer Cab Company each Wednesday evening at 7:30. The Pioneer Cab Company is located across from the Nordale Hotel, and their telephone number at your service 24 hours a day is East 10A. Be with us for another Here's a Pioneer next Wednesday evening, 7:30. Here's a Pioneer, and once again, Joe Coble and the staff of the Pioneer Cab Company have arranged a 15-minute visit with one of Alaska's old-timers. Tonight's studio guest is Dr. S.N. Bradley, and I think I'll begin here, Sig, by saying that I think you are the youngest old-timer we've had on this series. You were born in the territory of Alaska, weren't you?
Yes, I was born here in 1908.
When you say here, you mean Fairbanks.
I mean Fairbanks, yes.
Uh-huh. Well, I can imagine that during the next 14 minutes or so, you can tell us a lot about the early days in the Fairbanks vicinity in particular. First of all, I'll begin by asking you something about your family when your parents came to the territory.
My dad came up into the Dawson country in 1897.
97. Well, that really made him an early comer to the Northland. What was his occupation when he came up?
Well, he came up to mine, but he was a shoemaker by trade.
Did he stick with the shoemaking or branch out into mining?
He mined in the Dawson country, and then when he came down here in about 1906, I believe, he used to operate the 11-mile roadhouse out on the Tanana River on the old Valdez Trail.
Uh-huh. Well, we certainly are interested in some of your early day recollections of the Fairbanks vicinity, Sig. Will you tell us something about school days in Fairbanks in the early days? Do you remember the time when the original schoolhouse burned down?
Well, the first schoolhouse was the building that stands now on the corner of 2nd and Noble Street. Belongs to Mrs. Ford. It's a big three-story building. That was the original school building. Then there was a school building built where the present one stands now, up there on 8th Street off of Cushman.
Oh, yes.
But the old original building there was a frame structure, and it caught fire one night and made a pretty hot blaze.
I suppose that was a happy night for all of the Fairbanks school children, too.
Well, they thought they were going to get by pretty lucky, but all of the different club rooms around town were authorized or given four school rooms, and the Eagle Hall, the Moose Hall, and different places like that were used for temporary school for the balance of that year.
Say, as long as we're talking about some of those early day buildings, where was the early federal building located?
Right where it is now, Al.
On the same location. I understood it was back near 3rd and Turner. What building?
The jail was on the corner at 3rd and Cushman, and the federal building was at 2nd.
Mm-hmm.
It was two buildings, and then in back of that was the old Washington Alaska Bank building, which the government used later as a storage warehouse during the bootleg days. They kept the stills and all that sort of thing in there.
I see. All that sort of equipment. I understand, too, that through the years here at Fairbanks, you have served as a member of the fire department or as a volunteer. Is that right?
I worked a little over 5 years on the regular fire department.
And I noticed, too, that when there's an urgent call here locally, even now, you're right on the ball and ready to help the boys out.
We all have to do our part on helping.
Do you remember anything in particular in regard to some of the historic fires that Fairbanks has endured? You needn't tell us about the ones of the past 2 or 3 years. I think we know about them.
Mm-hmm. Well, there was a bad fire on 1st between, from Cushman clear down to what we call Easy Street or Blanchfield Street now. That was, I believe, in 1918. And that burned out the Fairbanks Corner and Fowl's menswear, and Wachter's Meat Market, and the Model Cafe, and the Arcade Cafe, and I took out everything that was in that area.
Mm-hmm. Some of your earlier employment, I understand, included the running of some of the earliest motor stages up here in the North Country. In what direction did they run?
Well, I used to work for Sheldon and Galen, and that was 1922 and 23. We used to drive to Chittenah and Valdez. In those days, we had Fords It was a three-day trip to get to Chitna, and if we went to Valdez, sometimes it was 3.5 or 4 days. The roads were not like they are today. Quite often we had to build road, cut trees, and corduroy the road and get over the swampy places. It was quite a little ordeal.
Those cars you were driving, or stages, were more like trucks, weren't they?
No, we used just the regular old Model T open-air Ford. Tom Gibson had some deluxe models that were Dodges. They were still open-air, but they were a little more comfortable than the Ford.
I suppose you had to depend on the passengers a lot, too, and
everybody had to help when we came to a muddy place. Why, everybody helped.
I suppose that was included in the deal when the passenger agreed to go with you. How about your fuel for a trip like that?
Oh, there was, when we were traveling empty, that is, when we didn't have passengers, we would haul gasoline and oil and store it in the different roadhouses along the way. But speaking of the passengers helping, I recall one time that Tom Gibson hauled a man to Chitna, and they were a little bit late getting in there, and they missed the train that run from Chitna to Cordova. And this fellow sent Tom a bill, and if I remember right, it was $198 for cleaning his clothes and the extra time that he'd put in working, pushing the car across the highway. And Tom, I believe, still has that bill framed. I don't believe that the man ever got his money.
Uh-huh. Well, that certainly is interesting. You must have been quite a young man when you were running those stages then.
Well, I was a pretty good-sized boy.
Mm-hmm. Also, another form of transportation that took your attention in those times, I understand, was working on the riverboats. How about that?
Yes, I made a few trips on the riverboats. I worked on the old steamer Reliance and on the steamer Tanana. Captain Livingston was the captain of the boat, and we used to go up the Kantishna River to Bearpaw and Roosevelt and then haul ore down to the mouth of the river in barges, and then the bigger boats took them on down the Yukon and wherever their destination was.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of river boats, brings us to the subject of getting across the Chena River right here in Fairbanks. I understand that in those days it was quite common for the bridge, a wooden bridge at that time, to go out. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. The bridge would go out pretty nearly every year during the breakup in the spring, and occasionally the high water in the fall would carry driftwood and things, and I remember once or twice the bridge went out in the fall. When the bridge was out, then they used ferries across the river. Was one ferry that started about where the model is situated and ran straight across to where the hospital is.
That probably would be one of the shortest ferry rides you'd ever encounter anywhere. Was that a toll ride?
That was a toll ride, yes. And then there was another ferry just like that that belonged to Mr. Kramer, and it ran from, down there on Wendell Avenue over to Grail.
When was the present bridge built?
I believe it was built in 1918.
1918, and that was quite an improvement for Fairbanks.
That was a big improvement.
At that time. Mm-hmm. You know, another thing that intrigues me is the stories that the old-timers tell about that railroad that ran all the way to Chattanooga, the Chattanooga Choo-Choo, we might say.
Oh, yeah, the old Tanana Valley Railroad is what it was called. This little trinket they have over there now is one of the original locomotives. And I remember them telling a story about taking two flat cars loaded with men going to Chattanooga, and seems that there was a hill in the vicinity of Dome, and everybody had to get out and help push the engine up over that hill.
Mm-hmm. Why was that abandoned?
Oh, when the road was put in to Chattanooga, it was so much easier to haul with trucks, and the time could be made so much easier. After the Steese Highway was built, why, there wasn't any reason for running a narrow-gauge railroad.
Just a matter of economics, then. What year do you recall when it was abandoned?
I don't remember that, Al. It's been quite some little time ago.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, too, one reason for the Chattanooga Railroad being finally closed down was the fact that the population that we hear was living in that vicinity in the early years has pretty well faded out.
Well, there's hardly anybody living at Chattanooga and Clary anymore, but I understand there was about 30,000 people there in the early days.
Mm-hmm. Now, something about aviation when Fairbanks was extremely young, that is, when aviation in Alaska was extremely young, I might say, too. Do you remember when the first plane flew in this vicinity?
There was a fellow by the name of Martin brought up an airship. I believe it came up on one of the barges, came up from St. Michael's and was hauled up to where the present airport is, and there was an admission charge then, and I believe he flew at about 20 minutes. And that was all.
I suppose that was one great day for Fairbanks. Was it a special holiday?
That was on a Sunday. I can't remember the date on the thing, but everybody in town was either up there or standing on their roofs watching over the fence. And
what was the landing spot?
Well, the landing spot at that time was where the baseball diamond used to be. He didn't have a great deal of room there.
I understand that Carl Ben Eielson is regarded as the father of Alaskan aviation. Will you tell us something of him? Wasn't he a school teacher?
Yes, he taught school. I went to school under him, and Ben was always wanting to fly, and he got some of the businessmen here to back him, and they brought up an old Jenny, an old biplane. And I believe Ira Farnsworth was the man who set it up and tuned all of the wires and saw that the wings were level and everything. And then Ben flew the one summer and taught school that winter. And then he got a contract to fly mail to McGrath. And I believe that he made 7 trips. His contract was for 10. And the last trip he made, he landed on the muddy field and one wheel caught in the mud and tipped him over and he broke one wing. Incidentally, on that trip, he was hauling mail and not supposed to haul passengers, but he had a man who had been stricken with paralysis, and they loaded him in the mail compartment and then closed the top down, and when they turned the thing over, why, this, they had to cut the opening and let a man out, and he fell out onto the ground. He didn't hurt him any, but he got up and walked away, but he had been paralyzed when they put him in the plane, so the scare must have cured him.
Eielson learned to fly in the First World War, didn't he?
I understand he was an instructor in the Army during the First World War.
Do you know anything of the end of his career?
He was killed in an accident over in Siberia in 1929. He and Earl Borland was his pilot or mechanic.
Now, if what I hear is correct, you may be considered one of Alaska's earliest grease monkeys as far as aviation is concerned. Didn't you help Eielson with his ship?
I helped him quite a few little different times trying to... Oh, we used to have to heat up the oil and heat the water for the radiator, and we used to do that at night and have everything hot in the morning when he'd get ready to start. It took quite a little while sometimes to get that plane warm enough to take off.
Mm-hmm. As a member of the Pioneers of Alaska, I imagine you're just about one of the youngest, aren't you?
I would think so, yes. There are some who are younger than I now that are pioneers. When I joined the Pioneers, you had to be in the territory before 1910. But that has been raised now so that if you're in the country before 1915, you're still eligible to belong.
How many of the igloos or local lodges are there? I suppose they're in all...
I don't know how many there are now, Al. There were around 20, but some of the places where the lodges or igloos, as we call them, were... The people have moved out and the mining is over and it's just a matter of ghost towns left. So those igloos have been disbanded too.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering what you think of your life in the Northland. I suppose you would feel that you've really lived a full life. I know you certainly enjoy yourself as far as the out-of-doors is concerned.
Well, I think that a boy raised in Alaska is pretty lucky. There's a lot of things we don't have that they do in the States, but we're free up here. We can go hunting and fishing and... we don't have to chase after streetcars and wait for the next one to come.
How about cable cars? Didn't you say that you took a shot at the outside at one time?
Well, I used to ride the cable car in San Francisco. I lived up on Pine and Jones. We used to take that old cable car and rattle up the hills.
And you decided that was when you were going to school?
Yes, I was going to college in San Francisco at that time.
Uh-huh. And it didn't take you long after you got out of college to decide that you'd like to come back to the North Country.
I decided that this was the place for me.
And you intend to stay for a good long time, too?
I do. I like it here. But I don't know of any reason why I shouldn't stay here.
What about the future of Alaska? What do you think of that?
I think Alaska has a good future. There'll be some new industries. I understand that a couple of years from now we'll have some pulp mills in Southeastern. I think when Alaska is made a state that we'll have a little more to say about our own things, and we'll make out fine and dandy.
Well, I'm certainly inclined to agree with you, and thank you, Dr. Sig Bradley. Friends, you've listened to another visit with one of Alaska's real old-timers, as arranged by the Pioneer Cab Company.